Put on the watch, light the cigarette, fold back the silk, and use the cigarette to burn a hole in the silk. Then put your eye up to the hole and look through, all the way through, until you find yourself falling through the hole and into the shifting patterns you see on the other side. Welcome to the Movie Vault. I'm Zach.
And I'm Ben.
And today we are reviewing the most Lynchian film in the universe, Inland Empire. It's David Lynch's 10th and final full-length film at the end of his 30-year directorial career. And the tagline is quite succinctly, "A Woman in Trouble." Pretty short, but it pretty much covers it, because even if you don't understand what's going on, she is in trouble. We have previously reviewed David Lynch's film Eraserhead, which happened about 30 years earlier in 1977. And it's on episode 58 of the Movie Vault. We did that last June. So be sure to check that out, as that was his first full length. And he's also done In Order, The Elephant Man, Dune, Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, Lost Highway, Straight Story, Mulholland Drive, all before Inland Empire in 2006 to cap it off. So he's done plenty of short films and great significant short films such as Dumbland, Darkened Room, and Rabbits, which has significant overlap with today's feature. And unsurprisingly, Lynch has his foot in the musical world as well, having directed a few music videos like The Wicked Game and Shot in the Back of the Head, also many albums such as Blue Bob, The Air is on Fire, and Polish Night Music, the latter two having a great large impact on this feature as well. And he has written 3 books and won an Academy Honorary Award in 2019 and Best Director at Cannes, along with Joel Coen, for 2001's Mulholland Drive. And much of his fame comes from his scripted television series Twin Peaks. Ben and I have both seen at least season one. That was in 1990 through 1991, and then also its revival in 2017. And then he also wrote and directed On the Air and Hotel Room. We at the Movie Vault are big Lynchians, and it is important to note that these things happen beforehand, as this film is pretty much the culmination of his career. And many of these things that I have just talked about are pretty much meshed into this, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, and I guess before we start the official review, we'll just tell a short little story about how we decided to review this movie. It was sort of on a whim purchase of on Amazon. It was Prime Day, and I don't even know whether it was on sale because of Prime Day, but the Criterion Collection Blu-ray of Inland Empire was on sale. I had seen that this movie really wasn't, I mean, I don't think you can rent it on Amazon. I could be wrong. Last I checked, you couldn't. There's not really too many places to get this movie, so I was like, I might as well, if I'm going to get a Criterion Blu-ray, which they're absurdly priced, I might as well get one that's kind of hard to find. So I ordered it, came in a couple days later. I'm like, well, Zach, we got to do this on the podcast. I didn't know anything about this movie, and I don't think Zach knew anything about this movie either.
Yeah, which is the best way to watch a film, because even David Lynch has a quote where he says, "I don't like to actually go into movies knowing something beforehand."
Yeah, and I really can't remember hearing a whole lot about this film other than kind of knowing that it was a little bit more, or it didn't seem like it got the press that some of the other David Lynch movies got, is maybe a good way to describe it. And after watching the movie, I could maybe tell a little bit why that was perhaps the case. But nonetheless,
Maybe it's a good idea to preface, like, if you haven't seen this film and you're watching this and you're listening to this, like, it's not going to make a single bit of sense. But if you watch the movie, you're still not going
to. Yeah. Listening to this podcast will not ruin the movie for you, because you're not going to understand it. But even if you have watched the movie, we might only be able to help a little bit on the understanding, or even what you're supposed to get out of this movie.
But we do have a few big theories.
Yeah, we do, and we've gotten them from a few good sources. Mm-hmm. There's one YouTuber in particular whose name,
I cited it. We'll get
you'll cite it. Okay.
But the thing is that this film, although we aren't going to get into every single detail, we do cover a ton of this film. So this is kind of a deep breakdown. And we're going to try to go for understanding. So we did kind of prep for this one comparatively to other ones. So
yeah,
mainly because we couldn't go into it. We wouldn't even know what to talk about if we didn't make a script.
It would be kind of a sporadic jumping from scene to scene within the movie, remembering, oh yeah, that happened, this happened. So you do kind of have to have something to keep you on track.
Yes,
because this movie is probably one of the more intimidating movies you could possibly review. Mm-hmm. And we were just like, sure, whatever, we'll do it. But
did you like it?
I loved it.
I loved
this
too.
Movie. And I think after watching videos and interviews and stuff, I only like it more.
I this morning, I'm ashamedly put it up half a star. So now it's at 4.5 stars.
Yeah.
I really think I'll get maybe get to I forget what the guy's name. He's famous. He writes for the New Yorker, but he hated this movie. He thought it was that David Lynch was kind of fool of himself with the project. That and I can read the whole review maybe towards the end of the episode if I remember. But that's just not what I get out of this movie. I see some guy who is like has such a vision to do something and try something. It is experimental because of the way he shot this was he would film scenes and then write scenes after. And the fact that he was able to even make something that we can kind of theorize has a complete succinct idea and has so many pieces that are interconnected and references so many things is kind of incredible.
And I'm going to ruin it early on, our streak, Ben. And our streak is zero right now, but this is Lynch's Oppenheimer, where he's built up a career to the point where he can do whatever he wants in this film. Yeah. And this is the I prefaced this at the beginning. This is the Lynchiest Lynch film that you'll ever watch in your entire life. And the craziness is so fun. Literally, you're just walking through an existential crisis for 3 hours, right? It's 3 hours.
Yeah, it's 3 hours.
This was not a film that Ben and I invited our friends over to watch. This was not a film to really do that. I'm not really sure anyone else liked it.
No, I don't think they liked it.
In fact, we had someone leave at like an hour in.
Yeah, this is a horrible first David Lynch movie. We can go into at the end also what the best David Lynch movies to start with is. I would say maybe like Blue Velvet to some degree, or Twin Peaks is pretty accessible one to start with, the TV show. I haven't even seen some of it. It's like The Elephant Man and Dune. Dune was kind of a disaster, but I think it's a little bit more straightforward, perhaps.
If we're talking first film, I'd say Elephant Man. It's
Elephant Man.
Not, it doesn't seem Lynchian.
It won't show you Lynch's weirdness at all.
But there are a few hints. It's like a little bit of salt. It's in there.
So... we love David Lynch. I think he's a really inspiring guy. I think if you want to learn about a style of filmmaking that's not the traditional, like, oh, you make a plot structure and it has to be very formulaic and all of that, you can see really what you can actually do with the medium of film. And David Lynch has a lot of respect for the idea of film, and it is very self-referential in his love for filmmaking. Like, it comes out in his movies, and it's like, in some ways it feels like David Lynch is kind of like Laura Dern in this movie, where his life is the movie and all of that. I'm not sure how, like, you know, I can't really speak to his personal experience, but sometimes it feels like he's so in the movie that it has to be that way.
Yeah. And before we start, and we're about to, Lynch even says that we are supposed to draw our own conclusions from this film. But he did have ideas in mind in making this, right? But at the end of the day, he didn't want to connect every single detail. What he wanted is this open, ambiguous, interpretative film that we can enjoy. But these are our best thoughts that we have, and the internet's best thoughts. Yes. So.
Yeah. And I think Lynch says he wants to leave room to dream. I mean, I saw him say that in an interview. It's kind of one of his catchphrases. He hates over-describing. And I even saw somebody point out that one of my favorite movie, Donnie Darko, was directed by Richard Kelly. And somebody on a podcast I listened to pointed out that Richard Kelly and David Lynch have some similarities in sort of their tonality and structure. But Kelly always falls to over-describing and over and wanting and – it is a puzzle, and he kind of gets these Nolanistic.
I was about to say, Kelly arcs. Seems like the disgusting, defected baby of Lynch and Nolan.
Nolan, exactly. And it doesn't work well in every one of his movies besides Donnie Darko, from what I've heard. They use Southland Tales as an example. It's like really cool, and then all of a sudden it like has to have an answer. Lynch knows how to have a mystery and then have you be the detective. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's beautiful that we're pulling from all these different parts of the internet, because it's a communal experience getting to try to solve a David Lynch movie. Never truly solve it, and everyone will have their own speculation on what it is, but that's the actual fun part. So I think there is something to say, like, we don't have to just say Inland Empire is an abstraction that we'll never understand, because I think I read a lot of people that say that. No, there is like things to be found within this movie, it still is kind of open-ended. Also,
you're definitely right, but after seeing and thinking about and pondering and thinking about these things, there are things that I've thought about and structures in this film that have come up in my head that I can't unsee now,
right?
Yeah. So I believe there is underlying truth to this,
yeah,
even though it seems wacky, right?
Right. I definitely, there's a lot of people who will write there's no way to understand this, and I completely disagree with that idea.
Yeah. And I think that is why it gets review bombed, because people don't understand it and they're not willing to be that detective.
Right.
So without a further ado,
be Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
All right. So here we are. Inland Empire is an area of the Pacific Southwest of California. It's east of Los Angeles, and it's an urban and metropolitan center around the cities of Riverside and San Bernardino, but also Ontario. It's also known for having a lot of trains, which is why you hear a lot of trains throughout the movie, and they're kind of referenced in Rabbits. There's also trains, so there's that too. So it's an hour east of Los Angeles. It's one of the fastest growing regions in California. Within it are cobalt blue lakes, harsh deserts, lush pine forests, sprawling suburbs, and metropolitan cities. And over 4 million people call it their home. But even with their nice background, it doesn't matter, because David Lynch chose the name because it sounded nice. And only one person says Inland Empire in the movie, and mm-hmm. I believe he's Polish. And I kind of forget why he says Inland mm-hmm. Empire.
We'll get to that.
So here's a quick quote on the camera quality and editing from Roger Ebert, the great movie critic, who said, "In this sense, you might say Inland Empire is a digital film through and through. Not because Lynch shot it with the relatively small Sony PD-150 Digicam and fell in love with the smeary, malleable, and unstable texture of digital video, where the brightest Los Angeles sunlight can be as void and terrifying as the darkest shadow, or because of the first pieces of the movie were digital he made for a website and then grew and crystallized into a narrative idea."
Which is Rabbits.
Yeah. Inland Empire unfolds in a digital world, a replication of consciousness itself, hence the title, where events really do transpire in multiple locations at the same time, or for multiple times at the same place. Observers are anywhere and everywhere at once, and realities are endlessly duplicable, repeatable, and tweakable. This is a digital dimension where, to paraphrase Jean-Luc Godard, there's no difference between ketchup and paint and light and blood. On the screen, it's red.
What an interesting way to start this podcast off, because...
Oh, what a beautiful... if I ever wanted to be a good movie critic, I'd have to learn how to write like that.
Oh, for sure. But because it's a quote inside of a quote, and we're quoting it.
Yeah.
And that is just exactly what this film is. A multi-layered... What is the phrase he says? He says multiple times at the same place or multiple locations at the same time. Both of those occur in this.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing ride. So let's start off with the theoretical, the conceptual, what we take away in our psyche, right? So we'll get into the details after that, but making kind of like these mental connections as we're watching this film. When you first watch this film, the only thing you can do is hold on for dear life that you can make is some kind of connection, right? And people, when we were watching, were like, oh, look, 47, right? 4-7. Oh, wait, that's the quote that she said. Wait, that came true, right? But you don't know what any of it means, okay?
Right.
You got to think about that later and possibly rewatch it. But these mental connections are what we start out with. He uses these major storytelling devices like spaces and images and faces. Especially like these close-ups, especially like Laura Dern, Justin Theroux, is it Theroux? Is that how you say it? Yeah. Grace Zabriskie and Harry Dean Stanton. These are some actors that have tons and tons. We know the facial structures of these people because the camera is so close to their face. We know we're in the medical field. We can literally outline the lungs of Laura Dern because we have heard her breathe and we have heard. Like spit move in her mouth because the camera and microphone are so close. I mean, what do you think? Why do you think all these things were used in this film? It's more sensory, right?
Yeah. I had different theories on like the decision making, and it seems like the film, like there's different points where it changes the style that they use. So like in the beginning of the film, after the first 10 minutes, when we are introduced to Laura Dern is when you really get that in your face, like the old lady, the old Polish lady has come over to visit, and you're like, what are these camera angles? And and the video, it does look like home video a little bit, like Roger Ebert was saying. It's like the camera is very modest, and then some of the images get more surreal, and it the camera seems to take on a different life that's not quite as home video-esque, but then it'll transition back to, it's almost like the home video is like when you're supposed to think things are real, whatever that means, and then other techniques are used as you like disappear. But the weird part is that sometimes there's not like one real place mm-hmm. in the movie. It's like sometimes things feel realer than other times, but there's like points where characters transition from a surreal place back to a real place and then like back to a surreal, and it's really hard to mm-hmm. to kind of follow. But I think the camera technique kind of plays into that. But it's there also seems to be this underlying thing that Lynch is trying to accomplish simply by that he's using digital, like, and digital mediums are referenced throughout, and there's just all sorts of ways you could go with exactly what the significance of everything is.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So a lot of these things have significance, but they're ambiguous. When I think of, like, all these spaces and images and faces that he's using, he's repeating them because the multi-layered story is the same story with slight variations, right? So he uses, like, a street. He uses these female characters and the male characters to represent different iterations in different timelines, whatever, universes, realities, whatever you want to call it, because it's in the film, it's in the TV. And then you have, like, these also weird shots with these rabbits, and we'll get to the rabbits. So you have all these different types, and none of them seem like they fit together, right?
No, they don't seem completely distinct from each other, but they definitely don't feel... There's points where you're like, "Why? How did we end up here?" Oh, and that happens a lot throughout the movie. But then you start to... There starts to be some connecting points, and then you understand a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I agree with that. I think even the dialogue displays that as well, where sometimes you just have no... You can know, like, the story. Like, you can... It clicks right away, and you're like, okay, I understand where the story's going, but then the dialogue makes no sense. It's like you have to keep up with both aspects of the film. So that's a big part of it, is kind of just, like, trying to play catch-up the entire time. And Lynch knows that. He knows that you're going to do this. And this is a film that takes contemplation. It takes a lot of time to let it seep through your brain. It's not one that follows a logical story or pathway. In fact, it's lots of different timelines and stories going on at the same time. And you'll get hints of different areas at different times, and we'll get into the specifics. But
so, yeah, Lynch also uses time and space, and this is throughout all of his movies, but a quote that exemplifies this is, "I suppose if it was 9:45, I would think it was after midnight," which is said in the very first interaction between Laura Dern, and, well, the only interaction between Laura Dern and the Polish lady.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like the story is more like a web than a cohesive story.
Yeah.
And then later on, we see a point where it's like the character thinks it's 9:45 and then realizes it's midnight or something to that degree, and there's a significance to mm-hmm. it being after midnight.
Yeah. And we'll get to why, but I'll just say it right now that apparently the theory, the internet theory at the moment, is that after midnight is when the lost girl, the girl who's watching the rabbits, is murdered right. by the Phantom.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that a little bit later, but it's I suppose if it was 9:45, I'd think it's after midnight. That plays significance to know what time it is, because then you know that's like the only timeline you have in this movie is like, is it 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock? It's literally just like a night. Right?
Right.
And it's all these different storylines. So that's like your rock climbing wall.
And what's her line? Like, today is like tomorrow, and tomorrow is like... There's a line like that, too.
Yes. It's, I can't seem to remember if it's today, 2 days from now, or yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that represents what the storytelling device is. It's going to be told in multiple different ways. So some of the characters. So you have Laura Dern, who plays Nikki Grace, who plays Sue Blue in the film On High and Blue Tomorrows. So she's an aspiring actress. Just this is the overall character.
She's married to Piotrow, who also represents Smithy later on.
Mm-hmm.
And Piotrek, I guess, is played by Peter J. Lucas, mm-hmm. Who I'd never heard of before. Their relationship at the start of the movie is a little odd, because he seems to be involved in the making of the movie, but then also upset when she's in the movie. He's also very jealous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of... And then when he becomes Smithy later on, his character is completely different, but kind of represented by the same guy. So there's some significance between same way that as Laura Dern represents Sue Blue and others throughout the movie. It's like important to see the differences and similarities, I guess.
Oh, for sure. And even the lady, the Polish lady, and the Polish lady lays out the plot right at the beginning of the film. Right. So that's kind of like your safety raft in the middle of the ocean. But she says that it's the same story with slight variation. So there are variations between the
levels. And she says that by saying an old Polish folktale and then doing a variation on it. Mm-hmm. And then the variation of that story is represented later on. Variations about a girl lost at the supermarket in an alley. And then eventually we see Laura Dern as Sue Blue lost in the supermarket in the alley. Opening the door, and that is like a new world, essentially. And then in the background, there's this whole Axon End thing, but I'm sure we'll get on to that.
Yeah, and the other story that she tells is a boy who goes outside and kind of inadvertently creates this evil reflection of his when he gets lost in the world, right? And that was the only story. Those were the two Polish stories she told. Yeah. And this film that they're working on is kind of cursed, right? It has this Polish curse. So there's this Polish...
Yeah. Poland was very important to this movie, and I suppose that a very simple explanation to this movie is that they tried to be part of a cursed film, and then there was a curse, and it was confusing after that. But that seems like too easy of an out.
That is a take that people have. It's like really easy to just get out of it. Like it's just random stuff that happens because it's Polish curse.
But the movie was 47, or 47, in Polish, and. Justin Theroux's character, what's his name? Devin Burke. He also plays Billy's side in the movie On Hot in Blue Tomorrows. But Devin is like, well, I wouldn't have played in the movie if I knew it was based on another movie. He had this very like interesting.
I don't do remakes.
He doesn't do remakes. Like, but the movie was never actually made. It was only in production. Mm-hmm. And then the leads died. So that puts an ominous overtone. And Jeremy Irons, who in one of the podcasts I was listening to, they were like, Jeremy Irons gives a very like convincing normal non-Lynchian type of performance as the director of the movie, Kingsley Stewart.
Yeah.
And I love Jeremy Irons. I think recently I watched him in the David Cronenberg movie. Oh, which David Cronenberg movie was it? It's not Scanners. It's the one about the two OBGYN doctors who are twin brothers who fall in love with the same girl.
I don't remember.
So weird.
But yeah, I think that was probably the most normal performance in the film by Kingsley. And it's interesting that you say that because the film sometimes feels a little disconnected, and that's part of David Lynch's style, because I think you told me this, like he would literally just do a scene and then think of something and write the next thing, right?
Right.
That's like just such a crazy way. And then I think at the end he said, I'm as surprised as you are that it all comes together.
Right. It was like his path. And the fact that these actors would just drop, I mean, they couldn't have been getting paid that much for this. Mm-hmm. And they would just drop their hat or drop whatever they were doing. And this was a 3-year production. So it took a while to film all of this.
Okay.
I'm sure they was working around schedules and stuff. Dead Ringers was the movie that Jeremy.
That's right. Okay. You told me about that one. You said it was, I think your review was like, he's got a twisted mind or something like
that. Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
David Cronenberg, different kind of twisted mind from David Lynch, but equally as interesting.
For sure. So let's start with the old Polish woman. So about 10 minutes into the film, she goes in and starts asking Nikki questions. She says she's a new neighbor down the road or whatever, near the forest or something like that. And she asks her questions that she kind of knows the answers to. She goes ahead and says, I think you got the part, because they're talking about whether or not she got the part on High and Blue Tomorrows. And then she asks if it's about marriage and murder and if her husband Pietrik is involved. She says no, but then the Polish lady's kind of pushing a little bit more, like, oh yeah, I think you're lying to me. It probably is about marriage and murder.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Murder.
And she tells two stories, the one about the boy getting lost and creating his evil reflection, the second girl who gets lost in an alley behind the marketplace. And then she just immediately moves on and says, if it was tomorrow, you would be sitting over there, right? And she points at the couch, and at the end of the film, we'll get a shot where she's sitting over there.
And then it immediately transitions to her sitting there, does it not?
Yeah, it does, but at the end of the film was the actual time when she's sitting over there.
Oh, I didn't even pick up on that.
And then she says, I can't seem to remember if it's today, 2 days from now, or yesterday. That's, we got that. And then she says something that is very important. Actions do have consequences. And she mentions Nikki's unpaid debt. Okay? And we'll get, that's a big theme. That's a motive throughout this. Unpaid debt, actions have consequences. No matter what life you're in, that is one that is consistent between all the stories that we have, right? All the levels and layers that are in there. And then Nikki finds out she gets the part, and Pietrick is not that happy.
In a very comical scene where she's with two of her friends that we never see, and she's in this huge house, and she's just like, yay!
He just kind of looks so down. Weird. He just kind of looks down, and the camera angle's weird, and it's all fuzzy.
I love David Lynch. I think you would think that characters were bad at acting based on some David Lynch films. And it's not that they're bad at acting. It's that David Lynch is making them act like this. And it's so amazing once you realize that.
Oh, I agree.
So then we realize that we go immediately to a... Oh, what's the William... Do you have the William H. Macy line? Hollywood, California, where dreams and stars are made. Something like that.
Yep, it is. Something similar.
And so that's... also kind of an important point, because William H. Macy is only in that part, and it's just like a weird line. It transitions to, I guess it shows that like
it's like an interview.
Hollywood bug kind of thing. And then we go to this interview where, which is also very kind of a parody of a interview, where this interviewer asked Devin if she's gonna have an affair with
she's kind of implying that like Grace. She's pregnant.
Like, yeah, which is like so weird, because you're like, what interviewer would ask that question? Like, so you're kind of a womanizer, you're gonna have an affair with her, what? And Devin's like no, and Nikki's like, oh, of course not, like very innocent, which is a classic David Lynch thing, to have the innocent blonde in his movies. And it's so funny, and this is kind of the setting up that a Pietrick is a very important guy, well connected, and Devin's guys are saying, you really gotta keep it in your pants, like you can't mess with this girl. Mm-hmm. and Pietrick says as much to Devin later on in the movie. And then we get to this question, the question of who is Smithy. Mm-hmm. Because the set that we go to is Smithy's house, and I'm not gonna lie to you, I watched that entire movie, and I don't know whether I remember them referencing Smithy ever.
The only time is when I remembered is she looks back at the set the first time she goes to the set, and somehow she remembers, she says, Smithy's house.
Oh, okay.
That's so the only time. The only time. Reference.
So you do need to read the credits, because it's very important, because some of these people, you only know their name because of the credits.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Smithy? I think Smithy in On High and Blue Tomorrows is the... On High and Blue Tomorrows starts out as a simple melodramatic tale about people having two characters having an affair. That's Sue Blue, Kingsley Stewart. I think Smithy is Sue's husband. Is that incorrect?
Smithy is, I'm pretty sure I thought he was the one she has an affair with.
Oh, so she's the one he has an affair with.
No, you're right. Billy, no, you're right. Smithy's the husband.
Yeah.
And then they switch roles.
Okay.
Because Billy is the one she has an affair with. So then Sue and Billy get together, right? They're having an affair.
Yeah, but that's because in real life...
But it's the opposite, because the husband, the actors play different...
Right, you're right. It switches.
So that's when the old Polish woman says it's with slight variation. So then Pietrick plays Smithy, who is the actual husband. Oh, wait, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
That makes sense, because he's the husband. But instead of... But he gets cheated on. Okay, so yeah, it makes sense. Oh, no, but in the movie, yeah, no, you're right.
See, we're already so confused.
It's not a variation. Smithy is the husband, so Pietrick is Smithy, and then Devin in real life they have an affair, but in the movie they also have an affair.
And he's Billy.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. So it does make sense. Not a switch. Okay. So yeah, that's kind of the The film imitates their actual life. This is a big theme. This is another motive we'll touch on. Like, what is reality? Reality versus script. And there's even a part where they're having an affair, and she sees like, what? This feels like, this sounds like one of our scripts, where Laura Dern says that, and she doesn't realize that there are cameras on her. This is like real life for her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know that. But Kingsley is the director, and after he tells them that it's cursed and that the leads were murdered, this is where things start to get a little bit loopy, where she goes into the house. And everything goes on from there. So it's a Polish gypsy folktale that is the On High and Blue Tomorrow. And then it was called, what's the 4-7 in the language? What'd you say?
4-7?
Yeah, something like that. So as she goes into Smithy's house, that's when the transition happens. She doesn't see the set, and it turns into a real house in a real neighborhood. And that's when Nikki merges with her Sue Blue character, and Smithy's house becomes real. And that's kind of like, which is based off of Sunset Boulevard, which we'll get into a ton as well, where Sunset Boulevard, the main actress gets lost in her own character, right?
Yeah.
So that's a big theme of what happens throughout this film as well. So there are these multiple story level tales that cross over. So this is the first crossover that we get, like, in a thematic sense. There are many crossovers before, and people remember things from past lives or future lives as well. But this is the first time when someone's going from one world to the other. So she is now Sue Blue from this point on, about 45 to an hour in.
And it's very disappointing. Well, in some sense, it's disappointing for the viewer because you sort of get duped into that. You're getting this more straightforward plot after the first 10 minutes that make no sense. All of a sudden, you're like, okay, I can follow this. We're doing good. And then you get to this part, and it's just the next 2 hours are just chaos that could wear you down if you're not super invested in the Lynchianness of it all.
Yes. No, definitely. And it was interesting because there really is about a section of 30 minutes that makes complete sense, where she is going, although it really, the thing is, in that 30 minutes, that's not actually what reality is. We'll find out that, like, Laura Dern's character is actually in a much worse situation than she thought. And this was all just kind of daydreaming. And the gypsy Polish lady who comes in at the beginning of the film kind of describes this whole experience, and all of her predictions that end up coming true is kind of like this big hypothetical. If she doesn't stay faithful, and if she chooses the wrong thing, her actions will have consequences. And it's kind of showing this big hypothetical thing. That's a theory that people have as well.
Yeah.
This is a lot of hypotheticals on different layers because this movie is cursed.
So it's kind of intuitive, but I didn't see it until we watched that one YouTube video. But it's kind of this idea of reincarnation in this movie, whether it's literal reincarnation or more of a hypothetical figurative reincarnation, you know, we'll probably never be able to really know. But Lynch uses it as a device to show, I guess, maybe sort of somewhat the idea that actions have consequences, but characters have multiple lives. They have remakes. There's multiple stories with variations, but the same roots and themes. And actually, the kind of the best way that I've been able to think about this movie is thinking about it more like in layers, like which layer are we in? Because it's confusing because the layers sometimes merge together.
They use the same actors.
They aren't told in the exact order that maybe is that it's been described as like opening a Russian doll, but it's not always so smooth and neat as being able to see, oh, we're in the next doll. It's not Inception. It's like running circles around Inception.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a sort of like natural, there is like sort of a crest or like a trough maybe at the bottom where you're like, this is the lowest point that you get to. And then it sort of goes up, but it's not exactly a smooth ride down there and a smooth ride up. If that makes any sense. I think of the layers as you got the layer of Nikki Grace, Pietrick, and Devin. You got the layer of Sue Blue, Billy, and Smithy. And then you have the layer of
The Phantom. The Lost Lady.
The Lost Girl.
And I forget her name.
Yeah. And then you sort of go up into this half layer, so I haven't really thought about where it is, that's back to Nikki Grace, but it doesn't seem like the first layer. It's maybe Nikki Grace after,
yeah, it's either a dream sequence of Nikki Grace's layer or what her actual reality was,
or it's a result of consequences from her first layer.
So a hypothetical Nikki Grace layer.
Yeah So and when you look at it that way, you're like, okay, there's also a Smithy Sue layer that Smithy's going to the circus, and I don't really understand as much about where that layer
is. We'll get to that. That layer fits in as well because that's how they meet through the different layers.
Right.
So, anyway, you're right. So there's this kind of revelation about at the beginning of the film, which we can miss very easily. Just like when she says that it's Smithy's house. Like, it's just one line that describes a big plot point in the film, where the director Kingsley is talking about a 90-year-old niece, which points to the old Polish woman. So she is actually connected to the original On High and Blue Tomorrows, where she's possibly people think she's the niece of Smithy, or she's the niece of someone else involved in the original film. But somehow that's how she knows that it's an old Polish curse. And she could even be related to the person, or be the person who was who cursed that set and caused people to die. We don't really know, but either way, she is Polish. She's involved in the original High and Blue Tomorrow based on Kingsley's comment. And we do think that, like, it's this woman, because there aren't really throwaway lines in this, to be honest. There are, like, every line has some ambiguity that has some open interpretation, but it means something, like, right. whether or not you like it or not. So that kind of brings in the old Polish woman into the mix as well. And it's interesting because we'll get to it as well, but the old Polish lady, everything that she says comes true, and then we don't really see her at the end of the film. So it's kind of like she just comes in, predicts everything, and then leaves. So, but...
So there's a scene where Nikki and Devin have an affair in the bedroom of Piedrick's house, and just like their characters in the movie, and she remembers their past lives, and Devin calls her Sue. So try to understand. Now, is this the scene where they are in the blue kind of room?
Yeah, so they're actually in Patrick's bed, and then they're going at it, and she like is talking about a past life where she remembered something, and he calls her Sue, and it's like this. Their memories are flooding in.
Yeah, and Pietrick is watching.
Yes, correct. So which is weird. Yeah,
he doesn't say anything. He's just watching. So. Yeah,
Pietrick is but probably
in an angry, weirdest. Brooding way.
Yeah,
not sure.
He's not happy.
He's not happy about this. This is, although somebody did say he's like weirdly, for all of the what is said about power, how he's in power and how strong he is, he's kind of cucked in this movie, but. Mm-hmm. So maybe
that's true.
And David Lynch, you know, the sexual fantasy kind of thing,
he's a beta male,
is like tinges throughout, so perhaps.
Yeah,
I don't know, I'm not gonna read too far into that.
Yeah, that's probably a good summary of that scene. But in that scene he's seen to have like a green jacket, which plays a role as well, even into the short film that we'll go into.
And Nikki sees Pietrick watching her through the, okay, so this is in a different scene.
Yes. So this is describing the love scene. So there are parts where Pietrick is kind of watching her through the window, and she calls him Billy, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, well, why do you?
But there's Pietrick also Billy? The scene where she goes into Smithy's house, mm-hmm. and then realizes that she's inside of the set of Smithy's house.
Yes.
And she sees. Yeah, and then she sees both Billy and Pietrick watching through the window. Mm-hmm. She's yelling for Billy. Devin's running. We can't really, we don't know, because this has been re-shown from a different point in the movie. We're not really sure whether Devin actually sees her or not. And then they all kind of leave.
It's weird.
Reminded me of that scene too.
Yeah, but the significance of that is kind of just they're kind of mixing their personalities together. So when she calls him Billy, that's also like the memories are flooding in. Where this love triangle, it's a love triangle in every single layer, they're kind of mixing up their past lives with their new ones. So then right after that, it goes into a different scene. What is it?
The red lamp room. So there's a group of women who we find out are prostitutes later on, who encourage Nikki and show her and her the old street, mm-hmm. which is the street where the lost girl was murdered.
I believe so. I don't. Well, we don't know. So we don't theoretically, know that, yeah. I actually believe this theory that, you know, that dark like area where it keeps showing, like, and it had no significance in the film. I think that's where the lost girl was murdered.
Yeah, that's. I was thinking. I was kind of making that assumption.
Yeah,
but that is also based on theory, because they do never actually show that.
Mm.
And so yeah, we see this group of women. at different points, they start dancing to the locomotion, all kinds of strange things. And then, but eventually they present this idea of she needs to put on this watch, light a cigarette, fold the silk, use the cigarette to burn a hole in the silk, and then you put up your eye to the hole and all the way through until you can see yourself falling through the hole and into shifting patterns you see on the other side. And that's how she can see into the past, into the original film, which I believe you're saying is tied to the idea of Sunset Boulevard, where there's this original film.
Yeah.
Or maybe you'd call it the deepest layer, the phantom layer.
Yeah. Maybe so whereas it. The memories were flooding in previously, now she is able to see into the other film and consciously know that it's the other film.
Right.
So this is like a big changing point. It's about maybe an hour, hour and a half in where that she gets to see this. And I mean, it might even be close to 2 hours in, so it's pretty late into the film. But the main theme in this red lamp room, which red lights, you know, you think of the song Roxanne, don't have to put on the red lights, prostitution, you know, stuff like that. And then eventually it'll be revealed that Laura Dern's character is also part of that prostitution muggle, or whatever, the group of girls. So yeah. That's a major motif as well. But seeing into the original film really makes it a lot easier, because then all these rabbit things kind of start to fit together too. But we'll do like a just rabbit section as well, because the tough part about this is like you got to describe them what like themes at a time. You can't describe different scenes at a time. So these are grouped in different themes and everything. So if it doesn't make sense, that's probably my fault. So, but yeah. So what was it? So the next part is, so Devin and Nikki are actually, they're acting and they're in a scene. And I said this before, but she can't really tell what reality is. So she ends up saying, like, this seems like dialogue from their script. And then, then it cuts to her in Smithy's house living a normal life. She actually got groceries by going through the alleyway that the Polish woman talked about behind the marketplace. And a neighbor comes in, and it's a stranger. And Nikki is living there in Smithy's house. And the stranger says that she owes a debt, bringing back that theme that the old Polish woman said. Then it cuts to the Phantom and his wife, and we get the first introduction of the Phantom and his wife. And his wife is the lost girl who
is seen at the very beginning of the film.
Yes.
As a prostitute.
Yes. Yes. And she's throughout the film, she's in many different areas, and she's watching the bunnies, and she's doing all these different things as well. And she is told in the mental hospital that she was hypnotized to kill someone with a screwdriver. Well, actually, that's not her. That was the third girl who is her. And she tries to kill someone with a screwdriver, and that's in the original film when she was hypnotized to do that. So basically, in the Phantom level, you have the Phantom and the Lost Girl. The Lost Girl has an affair with another guy.
Smithy?
It might have been Smithy, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Smithy. And there, in the Phantom layer, there's a guy named Smithy.
Yeah.
Who she has an affair with.
Yes. And then that's the variation, because it's the girl who... Well, the girl has the affair in all the variations, but in this variation, the Phantom ends up killing both of them.
Yeah.
So the Phantom hypnotizes someone to kill the girl with a screwdriver. So he hypnotizes a random girl at a circus, because he worked at a circus. And then that girl reincarnated into Devin's wife, right? And this is the most like loosely based theory, but this is I can't unsee this, Ben. So it's like he hypnotizes someone at a circus, and then she is reincarnated into Devin's wife, who is the one slapping Nikki at Nikki's house, right? Right.
Yep.
And
when she walks in, and it's like it's Devin's house, and his wife doesn't know about their affair. Yes. And it's
Yes. And that girl ends up stabbing Nikki with the screwdriver on the street when she realizes that she's actually a prostitute, because she had been hypnotized to through different layers. I mean, this person had been hypnotized many decades before at a circus in their reincarnation or whatever, the story layer, the curse, whatever you want to call it, carried through into other character. So that's kind of where that originates. It's like, I was always wondering, like, why did Devin's wife just stab her with the screwdriver? Like, wasn't someone else hypnotized? But that's what it was. So in the circus, the Phantom had a hypnotist act. So the Phantom really is this big bad Thanos in this film.
Yeah. And the Phantom is at the root of that's why we're calling it the Phantom layer, because it's the root of the story is in the film, but then the film is kind of real because there's consequences from that layer in Poland going all the way back. And we can see the connections, because like, why else would Pietrzyk be Polish? And presumably his parents were who we saw, so they're Polish, so there's some sort of some, and then it's a Polish folktale, so all this sort of interweaves together like a spider web.
Then the curse could have come from any of them if you think about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is a big part of the film that will carry over, just kind of this love triangle. So that's part of the love triangle. So the Phantom hypnotized to kill the wife, his own wife, which is the Lost Girl. And the Lost Girl is Laura Dern's character. So they're the same character in different lives.
Yeah. And so in Kingsley's remake, Sue tells her husband she's pregnant, and he later says he cannot father children, revealing her adultery. He lashes out at her like the Phantom did. So we get two scenes of a guy beating a woman.
Yeah.
Not pretty tough watches, but they're both reacting because of affairs. I'm not saying that's the correct way to react, just saying that's why they were reacting that way.
I'm glad you had to preface that. Yeah, it really sounded like you were advocating abuse.
I'm really against men beating
women. Ben's against bad things.
Yeah, I'm against bad things. I'm against affairs too, but I'm also against bad reactions to it, hearing about affairs. The Lost Girl's in the street with a screwdriver. She comes across a dead girl who's presumably the old lead in the original film. She was stabbed with the screwdriver. This is the scene when she's like looking down and there's this like girl who's with blood on her. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to like re-remember these scenes.
Yeah, so that was when the Phantom hypnotized the other girl to kill someone and her innards came out. That was the Phantom's original wife.
Okay.
That was the Phantom's original wife. And then later on, we'll learn in a scene where they see on the street, where the Lost Girl sees the Phantom on the street, which is a crossover. And the Lost Girls, they kind of recognize each other, and they're like, "Do you know who I am? Do you know why I'm doing this?" And then they talk about like the Phantom's like, he talks about killing someone, and the Lost Girl thinks it means the Lost Girl thinks it means her. And then she thinks she understands, but then the Phantom reveals that he's actually talking about killing Smithy as well. So the Phantom doesn't want to kill his own wife. He wants to kill the guy that cheated on, you know, was the third guy.
Yeah.
The third wheel.
And that's why he says, someone who is close to you died, when he runs into the Lost Girl on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little hard to put together the pieces, but you realize he knows her because they used to be married.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's a prostitute because she's trying to make ends meet because she's divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, you think he starts out saying, it's weird seeing you out on the street. Like, it's weird seeing you being a prostitute. And then he indicates that this person's dead, but there seems to be some aspect of him saying, I want to tell you this person's dead because I was involved in killing them.
Yeah. He was like gloating a little bit.
Yeah,
for sure. But yeah, then Billy's wife, so her name's Doris, or not Billy, Devin's wife is Doris. I forgot her name. And she confronts Sue, and then in that moment, Doris remembers how she was killed by a screwdriver in another version of herself by Smithy's love interest. So there's even an interest of Smithy as well. And that was the girl who the Phantom hypnotized. And she was hypnotized to kill Sue in the same way by the Phantom. So that's kind of like this big love triangle that happens in all three of them. And pretty much everyone dies except for Laura Dern, except for Nikki Grace, because there is this realization that happens at the end that kind of breaks everything, breaks this cycle, almost the reincarnation cycle. But Ben, we should talk about the rabbits. What about the rabbits?
Well, the rabbits are almost immediately in the movie. The movie opens with the Lost Girl in a hotel room, going to a hotel room with a man. It's pretty obvious that she's a prostitute based on their dialogue, which is in Polish, but we can see subtitles. He says some pretty crass things to her. She is then crying. It seems like she does not want to have this interaction with this guy, or she did not want to sleep with this guy, or he did not treat her well, or something along those lines. And then she turns on the TV, and the rabbits are what's on the TV. So that's the first thing. And then there's just a little bit of the rabbits.
It's a little off-putting.
They're just saying stuff. It doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
And then I forget, how does it even transition from the rabbits? I kind of forget.
I don't remember. I don't know. It just kind of zooms, like it turns on the TV and then kind of zooms in. And then every time we see the girl's face watching it, when we go in and out of the rabbit realm, is what I call it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the rabbit realm plays this integral role. So I'm going to do a small little, try to make it quick then, because I got a quick side quest, because I watched the short film Rabbits, which was released in 2002, also digital. So what it is, the rabbit scenes in this film, right, they are just clippets of the actual rabbit short film, which is about 45 minutes, that was released in 2002, 5 years before this film was released. And the tag for that is, in a nameless city deluged by continuous rain, three rabbits live in a fearful mystery. So it's the David Lynch's short film. The three characters are Susie, Jack, and Jane. So they actually represent characters in the rabbit realm in the real world that we'll come to find out. So there are a few key things to think about in this film. So this is now I'm actually reviewing this rabbits part just because it plays an important role into the Inland Empire lore. So there is a lot of lines that don't really seem connected in this. It's kind of off-putting. The rabbits are very monotone, and it really just is kind of this creepy doll-like scene where these people are dressed up as rabbits in like this Victorian house. And applause kind of, there's like, it's like a sitcom. So Lynch calls it a sitcom, but it's a little bit interesting that he calls that, because it doesn't deserve to be called that. But there's like applause, and I think that indicates kind of importance, important lines. It kind of happens after. And you have different actors playing these rabbits. So Naomi Watts plays Susie, Laura Harina plays Jane, and Scott Coffey plays Jack. Rebecca Del Rio also plays Jane, the singing part of the Jane. And there are train noises in the rain background because of Inland Empire. So there are seven scenes in this 45-minute spectacle. So in the first, I'll just go very quickly through this. So in the first scene, there are all three rabbits. One's ironing. There's applause, and there are a few notable lines that happen. Most of them are disconnected from each other, but they talk about, it was a man in a green suit, and they say, were you blonde, Susie? And then, have you heard those things being said before? It must be after 7 p.m. So that refers to the timestamp, obviously, the green jacket in the actual film. And the room turns red, and someone is yelling unintelligible language. It's none of the rabbits. It's like a man's voice. And that's like the summoning. We'll get into the summoning later. Scene two, the camera's in and out of focus. Susie comes in and starts singing and talks about different things. So they just keep saying words. So, for example, I won't say it every time, but cold, siren, dark, smiling teeth, mowing ring, fingers, smoke, oil, heat, mirror, just words and words and words. Scene three, they come in and talk to each other, a few notable lines. I knew that was happened each time I thought about it. Are you going to tell? I was wondering when Susie was going to do that. And then it says, it's 11 p.m. It's 11:15 p.m. It's dark outside. Then, in season three, there are footsteps outside of the door. And Jack yells, quiet. And he goes to the door, and it closes. And Susie gets scared, so they comfort her. Scene four, it's the most disturbing of them all. The main rabbit, Jack, comes in and starts singing. And it's the creepiest thing I've ever seen, where he says, distant siren, old warm rock, a dog crawls. And then he says, and he keeps humming, and that part freaks me out. Something's wrong, something's wrong. That's a common phrase, something's wrong. Whenever they say something's wrong, it goes into, there's this cigarette burn in the top right of the frame. And that's when the summoning happens, where one of the rabbits comes in with two candles or two lights in each hand, one in each hand. And that's kind of where the crossover happens, where they're able to access the real world, because the cigarette burn in the top right corner is actually what Nikki is putting into the silk. So that's kind of like the portal between the rabbit realm and the real world. Scene five, it's just the other two rabbits besides Jack. So it's the two female rabbits, Jane and Susie. And it says, I do not know where Jack is. It was the voice of a man. It was near the harbor when it happened. It was raining. It's 8:35 p.m., another timestamp. Who was on the phone? That's referring to the call that Laura Dern's character overhears of Jack the Rabbit. I've known since I was seven. And then the phone rings, and Jack answers it. And the only other time that the camera angle is not on the room is when it shows this telephone. Second to last scene, it's just Jane. She enters in with applause and starts singing. Again, it's really creepy. A lot of different words that she just says, but she repeats this, distant ships, distant ships, distant ships, distant siren, talking about like this calling that's happening to her. She also repeats all these different words that Jack talked about. Scene seven is Jack and Susie. They say it was red, referring to the red lights that we see throughout the film. No one could know about this. Jack leaves. Susie yells, it's past midnight, which is a reference to the film, obviously. The room turns red, and another summoning occurs. And the third rabbit, each rabbit has their turn to kind of have the summoning. and the door opens by itself all of a sudden. The rabbits kind of look over, and then the door closes. Susie says, and then there it was. Jack says, no, nothing. And then Jane says, well, then it must be very dark. And then the last three lines, Jack says, it was the man in the green coat. Susie says, I wonder who I will be. And then it fades to black as all three cuddle once more. So a lot of repeated phrases, kind of like, it was dark. The man in the green coat, I wonder who I will be. And then something's wrong. Something's wrong. They keep saying that. So I watched this by Movie Matinee, who has it the full length on YouTube. You should watch it if you can, Ben, some other time. But this film really, I mean, this short film really does play a huge role in Inland Empire, because it kind of lays the foundation of all these phrases were actually implemented into this film. So Lynch had been thinking about these things since 2002, the year we were born. Like,
yeah.
Then he comes up with Inland Empire.
That's crazy. And just hearing about that, I think I like flipped through Rabbits and I was just like, well, I'm not going to watch this 42 minute thing of them saying random words, but it's not exactly them saying just random words. It actually has some sort of,
I would watch Inland Empire before watching Rabbits. Rabbits will make no sense otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, back to the story. That was incredible. A side on Rabbits, but it foreshadows everything.
Yeah.
And the actual clips are used in Inland
Empire. Yeah, and they are. And I could tell the points, a lot of the points where they were used. I was like, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that was a point that mm-hmm. was used in Inland Empire. So Sue seeks help from the Rabbit Man later in the story when he crosses over or is summoned through a cigarette burn into this hotel, or not hotel, it's a stairwell that leads up to a room. Mm-hmm. Another motif that's used throughout, as the walking up the stairs is used multiple times, especially towards the end of the movie. This guy was described by Cornpoke Flicks on YouTube as a detective.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether he's actually a detective or ever actually referenced as a police officer, but he seems to be someone who's interviewing her.
Yeah.
And at this point, she's in her Sue Blue character because she's talking like a hick.
Yeah, she's talking.
And she's telling this story. She tells him this very long story about how she grabbed this guy by the balls and gouged his eye out, essentially.
That was one of my favorite parts.
Yeah. And she talks like very slow and deliberately. Not exactly like that. But then there's the backyard barbecue, which is life before the affair, and she's happy with Smithy and starts to feel like she had a prior life. She sees these two girls in the yard. She says, look at me and tell me you don't know me. And same as the lost girl asked two girls in Poland that are the same girl. They're obviously the same actors. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of like remembrance between the two lives.
I wonder, I'm just thinking about this now. I wonder if those two girls are the two girls that celebrate when she finds out she got the part.
Yeah.
That would kind of make sense.
The Phantom is named Kremp. He's a neighbor. And he lives next door to her and Smithy. And she remembers a past when she was in the circus with the Phantom. And he had a hypnotism act. But this is really strange because Smithy also leaves to go to the circus with his Polish friends as a lion tamer.
Mm-hmm. That's how they meet the Phantom.
In this, this is still in the Smithy Sue Blue realm, right?
Yes. Sort of. So the circus carries over into both layers.
Yes. He spills, and then Smithy spills ketchup. He's literally making a bunch of hot dogs for all these people who are going over. It's just like, it's the most ridiculous looking thing. And
it's a ton of ketchup.
And he spills a ton of ketchup on his shirt. You're like, how did you do this? And so that maybe references when the girl rabbit said it was red.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty incredible stuff. I think the Lynchpin podcast that I was listening to, I think they were saying that this is the part they struggled the most to kind of mold into the rest of the movie. Them being in like the sort of like Americana, lower middle class, Midwestern, maybe not Midwestern, maybe it's in the Inland Empire still probably. Yeah. But sort of area that's kind of like a little bit run down, and then him somehow going to the Polish circus. It's all incredibly odd with Smithy. And it doesn't seem like the very showy, melodramatic, like they're dressed up scenes in the actual Sue Blue, Billy, movie, so you're like, it's supposed to be, she's supposed to be Sue Blue as Smithy, but it doesn't feel exactly like that.
Yes, but this is my theory for that. It's headcanon. That is the actual real world, and she gets kicked out of that house when he finds out that she has an affair, because that's the house that they talk, they have a conversation with about having a kid, right? And then
in that house, this is just the first time they've actually been outside where it's not the alleyway.
Correct. And then they go into that house. That's like the Smithy's house of the real world. And
okay,
she gets kicked out, and then she finds out she becomes a prostitute in the real world.
Okay.
So I think that big house at the beginning of the film was like a dream. I don't think it was real.
Okay.
Or this is like the life that she lives if she has the affair.
Yeah.
One or the other. So I think this, because this plays into, because their neighbor is the Phantom in this real mid-American realm.
Yeah, in Inland Empire, which kind of makes sense, because then it's like, okay, now they're actually set as living in Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It feels more like that area of California, whereas I don't think the huge mansions are representative of what I think of when that's what I think of, like probably Beverly not. Hills or like a rich suburb of LA.
Yeah, and they're near movie sets, so we're probably to assume that.
Yeah.
So then it kind of cuts to an actual remake of a scene from Sunset Boulevard, where the line is said, and it's the same quote, "Cast out the wicked dream which has seized my heart." She is so ingrained in this Sue Blue personality that she cannot tell reality from script, to the point where all of her lives are meshing together, whether that's the curse or actual realms coming together or just like a dream or whatever theory you want to put on it. These different realities are coming together. This is a good little side note that I thought about. So what do you think about life imitating art or art imitating life?
I hear those words and I'm just trying to distinguish what that's supposed to mean. Like, I'll just break it down for myself. Life imitating art. So like my life would be imitating an artistic work,
mm-hmm.
or art imitating life. I think I tend to think of art as imitating life more than life imitating art.
Okay.
But it seems like this is sort of a circular thing where one starts, or we don't know where it starts, and it just kind of keeps circling back.
And that's exactly what art, this film is.
Because if you think about it, we do watch movies and stuff, and it influences how we think we should live to some degree.
True.
Like, to some subconscious degree, it shows us these feelings or representations of what we think is a good life, or sometimes we're like, that person's really cool. I might actually physically try to imitate them. Or it might be more of this film evokes the certain feeling that I want to feel in my regular life. So in some ways, entertainment and stuff can cause us to imitate itself. But also, there wouldn't be entertainment if it wasn't an imitation of life.
Yes, you're definitely right. And that's exactly what this film is in a grander scale. So the references and foundation of Sunset Boulevard plays an integral role in this, because there's another film called Queen Kelly, who was directed by Eric von Stroheim. And this film was not seen by many people.
Who was in the US. German, but he filmed in Poland.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, it's so weird, because it's like, make up your mind. Are we doing a German thing or a Polish thing, you know?
Yeah.
But Eric von Stroheim directed this film, Queen Kelly, which starred Gloria Swanson, who's in Sunset Boulevard, correct? And
an early work of hers.
And she walked off the project. The film was not finished. People think that this film kind of represents that, the On High Blue Mountains or whatever it's called. I forget what it's called.
And then Eric von Stroheim stars in Sunset Boulevard as the butler.
Yes. So
this is so bizarre.
It's just
so
like
strange.
There's no way this is a coincidence, is what I'm saying. Like, the people who this might be based on were in the movie that it is based on, you know? Like, Sunset Boulevard is not the film that was unfinished. Sunset Boulevard influenced other parts of this film, but in Sunset Boulevard there's an actress and the director of it were involved in a film that oddly relates very closely to the foundation of this film. So there are two films that might have influenced this but are interrelated.
And in Sunset Boulevard, Gloria Swanson's character becomes Salome, who is the niece of Herod who dances.
Which would make sense, because the niece was the 90-year-old woman.
Interesting thing, I've actually watched a play of Salome. It's quite something to behold. It's really, really weird. I got to go into the story. In one of my classes at Otterbein, it's called The Shock of the New. It was about early 20th century music. and we had to watch this performance of Salome. So as you know, the story is in the Bible. Herod, his niece dances for him, and he says she can have anything that she wants, and she says that she wants John the Baptist's head on a platter. We don't get a whole lot of context outside of what actually happens. I think Herod's wife is involved in wanting Herod's head on a platter, so she doesn't like Herod, probably because of things that he said about Herod and their family.
Oh, the drama.
But in the production, it's a lot more sensual, where
she's like in love with him.
She's in love with him, and the dance that she I can't even remember when she has the head on the platter and she has, it's so weird.
Really?
Yeah.
And this is what you had to watch in college?
Yep.
Man, you paid thousands of dollars for that.
Yep, to watch that. It wow. was, I was stunned in my seat after watching that. It was maybe one of the most horrifying things I've ever watched.
Hopefully it's not what actually happened.
No.
Definitely
not. I mean, I guess we don't know for sure, but I'm like, I think that's
a bit of the Bible kind of leaves that out, I bet, if there were some kind of dance like
which
that.
Which maybe, I believe she actually does dance with his head, or like start kissing his head after it's been beheaded.
Okay.
Or something like that. It's something really strange. I think I already started to blot it out of my memory, which is why I'm struggling.
Yikes.
Yeah. So
that was an amazing side note.
Yeah. What a side note for, I was like, I actually know what that is.
Yeah.
So we're still in Inland Empire. We're going on our own layers. But the Phantom sees the lost girl and they talk about killing Smithy's wife and then realize he was talking about Smithy himself. We've kind of referenced this part before. So the Phantom kills both Smithy's wife and him?
Yeah, so that's what he was referring to. The lost girl thought he was referring to Smithy's wife, but he was inferring that he was actually going to kill Smithy as well.
Yeah, and that Smithy's wife is who she sees is dead,
mm-hmm.
Presumably.
Yep.
Pietrick in the real world is with the bald guy.
The bald guy is Jack, who's the rabbit.
Okay, and they look for Devin.
No, sorry. He might not be the actual... He might be the rabbit. He's not the guy... No, he's not Jack. He's the bald guy that has... That the Phantom talks with in the big mansion.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know
his
name.
They look for Devin, but the man says he's in the Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dun, yeah. Dun, dun.
Yeah. And the man and the girl try a seance to communicate with the lost girl, and after midnight, they turn into rabbits again.
Yeah.
And Pietrick is there.
Yes, and that was a big...
And he gets a gun.
Yes, you're right. And that was like the big reveal is like the rabbits have crossed into this realm.
Right.
And they're kind of trying to like help Nikki almost and the main characters. It seems like in this film they're kind of fighting against the Phantom because they do supply the gun. So the rabbits supply the gun. Nikki finds it in that desk drawer where that red lamp is. So it's like they gave it to him to kill the Phantom. And I wonder why. Like, I don't know why that war is going on, but that's what happened.
There's that one scene in the very beginning of the movie with the Phantom and the rabbit.
Yes.
I think that there was something that maybe it could be interrelated. That's like at the very beginning. You almost forget about it.
And at the beginning of the film, that's when the Phantom is scheming to kill Smithy with the bald guy who has all that power and everything. So whatever that means, I don't know. I think it just means like he's scheming with someone else. So then there's this theme, one of the last motives we'll kind of cover in the actual plot summary is after midnight. So we actually think that's when the lost girl might have been killed in the ominous dark tunnel visioned that was many times throughout the film. Sue encounters Kremp, who is the neighbor who is the Phantom that that one homeless girl comes up and tells her about. And she was told by her neighbor, and when she goes up to him, he has this red light bulb in his mouth. And
maybe
she,
a representation of the red light district.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and she has this breakthrough, and her friend is laughing as she realizes that she is a prostitute.
But she can see a mirror of herself at first.
Yes, right? Yes, and that was interesting because I actually don't know what that meant. I really have no idea.
Yeah, she was like looking at herself across the street as a prostitute, but then she would also look like a prostitute. It was weird.
Maybe it was like she's figuring out what the reality is.
Yeah,
and she was kicked out of her house by her husband, just like the Phantom did to the lost girl. And Doris is stalking her. She came out of the mental asylum somehow. She tells the rabbit man in the attic area that she admits that she had a son that she lost. and the Rabbit Man receives a phone call, talks about a horse in a well, which actually is talked about in Twin Peaks later on, I think in the revival. But the man, the Rabbit Man on the phone, admits that Kremp is around somewhere, so Sue kind of leaves frantically, and that's when Doris, she comes out of the Axon door, and Doris stabs her with the screwdriver, fulfilling the hypnotism. And so that's when you kind of, it's kind of like, starts to come to, things are starting to come together, and there's one big final scene. Do you want to reveal the scene? This is the culmination, and I love that Terry Crews is in it.
The Terry Crews,
we call it the Terry Crews scene,
where he's a homeless guy with a homeless girl, and then there's a homeless other lady, and in between them is the dying Sue, with who's been stabbed with the screwdriver, and there's a very, very long monologue by the Asian girlfriend of Terry Crews, and I'm only referencing her that way because I think her name is literally like homeless person number two or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And she talks about this blonde, this girl in a blonde wig, her like cousin who lives in what part of LA does she even live in?
I can't remember.
some part of LA that they can bus to. Oh, it's Pomona. And she has a hole in her vaginal wall that leads to her intestine, which the Lynchpin podcast was like, well, there's a lot of things about holes in this, like holes in the sheets,
cigarette
holes in the vaginal walls. I was like, okay. It's just a very strange, very long monologue about this. And she owns a monkey and she lives there and in this house. And then after
we'll forget
all this,
to say it, we actually get to see this character at the end of the film.
Yeah.
In the credits, but I'm only saying that because I know it for
sure. Yeah, and that's the only way you would know who it was,
the
because
monkey.
Of the monkey and her blonde hair.
Yeah.
And then Sue kind of passes away, and we're like, what? Laura Dern's dead, and then the reveal is they pull back. This is all part of Kingsley's movie the whole time.
It's a wrap.
On High and Blue Tomorrows is perhaps... took a direction that was different than the melodramatic Hallmark movie-esque thing that we thought it was at the beginning.
But they finished it. That's the interesting thing, is that they finished this film.
Yeah.
And the old one did not.
But when she's done, she reacts a lot slower than the other actors, again, almost not realizing that it's not real. And even as she interacts with Kingsley and the other set people, she has this air that she like doesn't buy... what's happening. She doesn't buy that this film is over or that the film mm-hmm. is reality or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. That's what method acting does.
Yeah, that's crazy. And maybe this is just a method. Why you shouldn't method act movie. And then she becomes aware that the lost girl is watching her and watching her like a dark theater. She sees where the Rabbit Man went after the office. The curse isn't broken as the story isn't over, and it is after midnight when she is to die. She sees another axon in the door, and she sees Smithy's house set where she finds a gun under the red light and on top of Smithy's green coat. Did he intend for her to find it? We're not sure. The rabbits could be working against the Phantom, as we referenced. The Phantom approaches her in the hallway. We see that he is the reflection, or the doppelganger that has been haunting Sue since the beginning of the film, so that evil that was born and followed the boy. She shoots the reflection finale of... Sunset Boulevard, where she says the famous line, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
But the close-up in this is freaky.
It's the Phantom's face, and it's almost like a creepypasta thing where it's like Laura Dern's face for a second, like really stretched out and wide.
Yeah.
And then... she will not let herself become the adulterous Susan Blue and redeems herself by shooting the Phantom multiple times.
Yeah. And there's light on her, and she runs up to the camera with like this creepy face right before, and like that's the reflection that she's talking about.
Right.
So then the light shines on the Phantom's face, she shoots it, and this reflection is killed.
Yeah. And the lost girl rejoins those she loves, and actually, so she walks into that initial room, Laura Dern does.
Mm-hmm.
She and the lost girl kiss,
yeah,
which is strange, and then she disappears.
It's because it's herself.
Yeah.
So.
So. I mean,
they rejoined.
David Lynch just had to throw that in there.
Yeah.
And then
it's like meeting. It's the only time someone meets themselves.
Right. So. And then she, the Lost Girl, is reunited. Her son comes back. There's no more Blue Tomorrow since Sue Blue has been left behind. Very clever. Smithy and is there. They all seem happy. Sunset Boulevard is the dream, or the dream that has, the dream that she held on so desperately had enfolded her. That's what you're saying happened in Sunset Boulevard.
Yes.
And that is not what happens in this movie.
She was unfolded, I would say, but kind of brought back together. There is like redemption in this film.
Yeah.
So
that's nice.
I didn't know that until like researching after. It doesn't seem like there's any good thing that happens, but I did think like when her son comes back, that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and then there's a dance scene and the prostitutes come back and have a dance party and yes. they sing the song and there's a yes. monkey and there's a guy sawing. So. Yes.
Yeah. So that's kind of the gist of the film. if you're not confused or if you
I mean, that should pretty much explain everything to you.
I mean, mostly. I mean, honestly. Yeah, it's the end part. It really does culminate everything.
I mean, I was actually a little confused reading some of those parts, but I think I kind of
yeah.
understand after.
But it does really just go on this reflection that she has to kill. And since she wants to choose to be, she doesn't want to be the prostitute. She doesn't want to be the adulterous woman. That's when the cycle kind of breaks. And she shoots this reflection, and it's over. And the close-up she gets is this phantom's face, and, yeah, she redeems herself. So she gets to get out of this purgatory, and the lost girl, who is this past life, gets to be set free, and it's an amazing scene. So that's Inland Empire. What is your favorite David Lynch film?
Oh, man. Right now, Mulholland Drive is listed as my ninth favorite film of all time.
Wow.
I believe Eraserhead is also in my top 75 somewhere. And then probably Blue Velvet. I've not seen The Elephant Man. If I really look at it, I haven't seen that many David Lynch movies. There's a lot of them I haven't seen. I have it on my list to watch Fire Walk With Me, but I kind of have to watch the other
two seasons. Yeah.
Or at least season two.
It's between seasons two and the revival.
I think it's a prequel, but you're supposed to watch the first two seasons yeah. before you go watch it.
Yep. Yep.
And it's about, I forget what her name is. The girl.
Laura Palmer.
Laura Palmer, who yep. is important
yep.
in the first couple seasons.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. Yeah, I don't know. I think Mulholland Drive is great. This is great. Eraserhead's great. Thing is, my first film was Eraserhead for David Lynch. So yeah. like that has a classic category in my head. This was great, but Mulholland Drive, like, is just, I think, a better quality
film. I think it's better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just
think Mulholland Drive has a lot of similar qualities to this movie.
Yeah,
I'd say so. But it feels more cohesive.
It's dreamlike.
It is very dreamlike.
Yeah.
And it's also probably more theorized about.
Yes.
Because more people watch it.
For sure. And that's one of the, there are tons of several themes that kind of recur in all of his different works. I have tons of notes. We're not going to have to read through them all, but. One of the big ones was dreams. So you have these.
Yeah, dreams.
This dreamlike sequence and everything that he's ever done. It's Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire, Eraserhead. The logic isn't fully there. It's not reality. It's almost like as long as the concepts are related, he's good to move on, you know? So he's not too concerned. Even in The Elephant Man, like John Merrick, the guy who's deformed elephantitis, has a dream of his mother. And like that's his most normal film. Agent Cooper in Twin Peaks kind of dreams of the Red Room and like in that curtain-esque area, which honestly, the curtain-esque area looked like the circus in this,
yeah.
in Inland Empire. I thought that kind
of
looked cool.
And that was the one thing from the Lynchpin podcast. They had watched all of Twin Peaks and they kept referencing back, and I had to kind of skip through some parts because I didn't want to hear too many spoilers.
I know.
Not that it would matter because you really can't spoil Twin Peaks.
Season one was so good.
But they kept saying, this seems like Twin Peaks. It seems like he did this, and then he did it in Twin Peaks The Return.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. I think they also pointed out that he does a lot of stuff with affairs.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he does. I mean, there are 9 in the first season of Twin Peaks.
So
quite literally, no. I think we mentioned this, Ben. No one is faithful in Twin Peaks.
No. Yeah, nobody is faithful in Twin Peaks. Everyone's having an affair.
Yeah.
It's pretty insane. Blue Velvet is a little bit more straightforward. Blue Velvet is really Lynch's breakout movie, because Eraserhead is a cult, kind of a cult following. Probably more people returned to it after they knew who David Lynch was.
Yeah, I agree.
Dune was a disaster. Elephant Man, actually, I think was pretty successful.
Yeah.
But Dune after was a disaster because it was just studio and him, and they probably were trying to do it too soon in reaction to Star Wars, that sort of thing. And just from all I hear, it didn't really work out. Blue Velvet was a, was still probably a cult film, but it was a underground sensation. Like, people went and watched it. It was, there's a Noah Baumbach movie that they're like watching Blue Velvet in the movie. So that's really kind of where I was like, oh, so it's sort of like had that aura of being like a cool, like,
I can't imagine nerdy, that, 'cause he just made Barbie movie. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. But Blue Velvet is a disturbing movie with some really messed up people in it. Mm-hmm. But it's also just like set up as this like whimsical mystery that's like, ooh,
that has
found this ear.
Agent wow. Cooper in it.
That has Kyle MacLachlan in it.
That's right.
It's, and is Laura Dern in it too?
Or I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I'm not sure.
I'm going to check on that. But yeah, but the, and Dennis Hopper's performance is so terrifying, but it has some memorable lines. It sets up all of the Lynchism that people love, the like the mystery, the way the characters talk to each other. It really sets mm-hmm. everything up for Twin Peaks, which I think mm-hmm. just like expands on everything. Wild at Heart and Lost Highway, I've not seen. Wild at Heart, it seems like somewhat of an oddity to me, because it's like a Nick Cage is in it.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
And Lost Highway, from all I've heard, is also just a mystery that's weird and interesting. And then he did The Straight Story, which is G, and you can watch it on Disney Plus.
That's right. That's a Disney film.
Yeah.
I forgot.
And it's probably another one of his more normal movies.
Yeah. It would probably have to be. There's no way Disney would appreciate his work.
Yeah.
Disney likes routine.
So yeah.
They like to know exactly what they're getting, which is why they might be bought by Apple.
Yeah.
So, which I hope they are. And I hope Apple destroys it, like incinerates it.
That'd actually be funny if Disney got bought. Does that actually have a rumor?
It is a rumor, because they're doing very, like, they've lost billions in the last few years.
Even Bob Iger can't write the ship?
I don't know. I'm not sure. We'll have to see. He's newly in there. It's been a year only. So.
It's funny because Apple has the bite out of them, but it's like they're biting with the little bite.
Oh, the logo?
Yeah.
I guess.
You swallow it.
I guess. But that D is some sharp edges.
Yeah, true.
That's kind of weird.
It kind of fits in.
Yeah.
They're like connected.
I guess. Like, you could fit the D.
I'm thinking like David Lynch right now. You could fit
the D in the Apple.
Yeah.
Great.
All right, do you have a favorite? Did you say Mulholland Drive?
I think it's Mulholland Drive, but I wouldn't be afraid to say Eraserhead.
Eraserhead's really good.
This too. Is up there too. Like, this is like,
this is probably third right now for me.
The thing about this is, like, I like chocolate cake, but I can't eat a whole chocolate cake.
Yeah.
You know? So,
that's a good point.
That's what I mean about this. But
fair enough.
What about this, what do you think worked for the Lynchian style? We'll move past that. What do you think the Lynchian style is? I mean, we know what the Lynchian style is. Maybe a better question is, how did the purest form of Lynch affect you in this film?
It overwhelmed me, but it inspired me, okay. I think. Because, well, we were watching it with friends, and a lot of the comments were, this movie was just a random sequence of things. And I think digging into the research and realizing, yes, Lynch did film this, like, writing as he went, but it was not just random. It was... No, what inspires me about Lynch, and it's seen the most in this movie, is how he actually makes something that feels like a dream. We joke about Inception a lot on this podcast, because Inception, I haven't seen it in a while. I'm sure if I go back and watch it, I'd appreciate it to some degree. But that's not what dreams are like. People don't dream like Lincoln commercials. That everyone's not wearing a gold watch. And it's not so literal as like, you like fall asleep and then we're going into your dream within a dream. It's like dreams are so, we've all had those dreams where you start somewhere and it makes sense to you, and then you're somewhere completely different, and you know that there was something that connected the two, but you can't explain what it was, but it makes sense.
Exactly. That you're there. It's a concept level. No details matter.
Yeah.
That's the synapse. That's how it works.
Yeah.
It's just one, it just needs one connection and it'll go far with it.
Exactly. And Lynch, to the best human, best a human can do, actually captures what that feels like in cinema, which is an insanely difficult thing to do.
Literally, one of our friends pretentiously said, oh, I can make this in one night. And I wanted to punch him in the face because I was like, there's no way. I don't think you get what's actually happening. The layers are, it's not like he made this film like just randomly. Like he says that he made this film like just by thinking of something and writing it down and then doing it right away. But it's just crazy that it actually came together.
Yeah. And in the Polish parts, you're in Poland. It does not feel like you shouldn't be there. You are wondering why you're there. But it's not like, this doesn't make sense that I'm here in this part of the movie.
Which is like a dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I'll say about Lynch in general and in this movie. That works for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think the storytelling being out of time, out of sequence, out of character even, and having so many layers to the point where I have to be that detective. I have to be Jack the Rabbit in this film, figuring out what's happening. And then even like, that jump scare kind of freaked me out, where the close-up of the Phantom. Yeah. But so it had like a lot of key things that will stick in my head forever. And that is a good thing for this film, because there are probably 8 or 9 different things I will not forget ever. So good job, David Lynch. I really do respect that you just go for it with all of your might, and you do not care what other people think. What was the thing you said about him and a cow or something?
Wait, what about him?
He said like he protested with a cow.
Oh yeah, he was like he wanted Laura Dern to be nominated for Best Actress, which that is one thing that a lot of people will agree. And even my guy from the New Yorker who hated the movie was like, it was a virtuoso, incredible performance by Laura Dern, because she had to play like 5 different characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he stood out with a cow. I don't know why he had the cow. Like in Hollywood, like. Saying that
I'm just saying that, like, that takes guts.
Yeah, it does. And this is sort of shifting to something different, but I don't know if it's seen as much. It kind of is in this movie, but it's more obvious in his other movies, is that Lynch loves to show like the violent, seedy underbelly of like seemingly normal things. So it's a lot of his like Blue Velvet, it's like beautiful suburban North Carolina or something like that, and then like the violent crime that's actually underneath, that you uncover, that's like just beneath the surface of society. Same in Eraserhead, same in Twin Peaks is hugely like that. It's like this place in Washington, right? It's in Washington?
Yes.
That seems like beautiful, idyllic area, and then all of this like crazy, almost supernatural evil is happening in that area, like just beneath the surface. In a place that seems like it's so normal and good, and then he really takes it out in his last two films Hollywood. His last two films, barring The Straight Story, that's in between them.
And he stopped making films when he's still at a prime age, so I think that also says something.
Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire really have undertones of like, what is Hollywood, especially Mulholland Drive, where he pokes fun at like studio executives in a room and like the guy who's like controlling everything behind the scenes, like, this is the girl, like, you will cast her. There's a lot of like, and I thought in this movie it's maybe less because maybe he's not as upset at the studios because he has full control, but it's like still this actress who's like has this idea that she's going to be famous, and like her dreams are dashed because of it connects to all the other stories, but this ideal of Hollywood and the wonder of Hollywood, and then like the actual you're actually going to be a prostitute on the street. Like, yeah. That's what David Lynch says.
Maybe nobody was willing to pick it up, and that's why he shot it on a Sony HD camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
But I so agree with that. I'm thinking like David Lynch would not fit in with any of these execs whatsoever.
No.
So there's that. And you know what this reminds me of a little bit? It kind of reminds me of Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared.
Yeah.
Slightly. The ends of them.
Yeah.
You know, I just think of like the random, like where the saxophone's playing off key and everything, and like they're just rubbing hearts on the table with glitter, and it's like just a bunch of random sequences, and then like creepy imagery of a guy with long hair like dancing in the middle of a kitchen like that.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It just reminded me of that.
I could see the Lynchian aspect of Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared.
And like the father that, you know, the yellow guy's dad. that like controls everything behind the scenes, and he represents the studio executives. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So that's similar to what you said. How can we fit insurance into this? I have no idea.
You crash your car in Hollywood, you should call Edmund Anglin Agency.
Then I'm going to say the number.
Yeah.
614-486-7300.
614-486-7300. Give them a call.
What do they have? What insurance? They have life now. That's life, right.
Auto, home, business.
Yeah, so life, auto, home, and business. We're in business. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lord Business from the Lego Movie.
We got everything you need. One stop shop.
Yeah, your one stop shop for life, home, and business. And
auto.
Auto insurance.
You bet. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it'll get better. We'll find a good one.
We'll get a better jingle.
Yeah.
Man.
What are we at time-wise?
We're like an hour and a half.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
Yeah.
So I am very grateful that we got to review his first and last film. They're very different. They really are very different. But the questioning, the detective work is pretty similar.
Yeah.
It's just Eraserhead's about half the runtime.
Yeah, and I do respect... Anything that makes Eraserhead seem like a more normal, cohesive story, you know, is like really, really intense.
Are those the top two weirdest movies we've done?
Probably.
So it would be Inland Empire's number one, then
Eraserhead. I mean, it depends. I think in some ways, Eraserhead has some like pretty disturbing practical effects and like different things than this offers. You're right. But I think overall, this movie is like, more convoluted, more difficult, and maybe more disturbing.
Yeah, it depends if you want to go more grotesque or convolution.
Yeah,
it's up to you, up to your discretion. But either way, they're both Lynch's films, so.
And I'd love to do more Lynch, although we'll probably space it out some.
Yeah, I would love to as well. I'd love to do more Lynch and Akira Kurosawa. He's also one of my favorites.
Akira with Jean-Luc Godard referenced in this,
possibly.
Artur.
I wanted to do more Jim Jarmusch.
Jim Jarmusch.
A lot of these great directors of our time.
Yeah.
Well, before our time, technically.
Because they don't exist. There's no great directors anymore. I'm just kidding. Yeah. That's not exactly true.
Actually, Jim Jarmusch and David Lynch kind of have the same hair. It's almost like the Dr. Brenner from Stranger Things kind of hair.
Yeah.
Is it Brenner? Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true, they do.
Anyway.
The wild, wild hair.
This was the most I've had to prepare for the movie vault. I'd had to really think
Zach
this
put
one
a lot
through.
Of work into this, so
I had to think.
I appreciate
through.
Zach, because I tried. Well, I watched some stuff, but the amount of notes that Zach had for this was impressive.
Well, I'm keeping it like in my Apple Notes that I can like reference it again and like act all smart and snobby.
Yeah,
that's what everything in my life. I try to get so niche into the culture, like coffee, you know, the nerd stuff that I'm in, like science and stuff like that. I try to get to the point where I can like. Just be so I can't relate to people, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I love
that. That's the fun part.
It is the fun part.
I mean, I can't. I want to just go when people like ask what I like to do. I'm like, oh, yeah, I like watching, you know, as obscure. Well, these aren't even obscure, but they're kind of like more niche artsy movies. And I like watching them. And, you know, I'm watching a Gaspar Noé film and, you know, random. You know, whatever I can get my hands on and also stomach, because, you know, you can only watch so many foreign films at a time where you have to watch, like,
that's
something
true.
That's actually...
Our gut microbiome is watch. Strictly American.
Yeah.
It's hard to digest some of those.
But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, but it's fun. I mean, you get most of my references, I'd say.
Yeah.
That's good. But most people probably... It's tough to even talk to me.
Yeah.
I make a movie reference in every conversation I've ever had, pretty much.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's how you relate. I mean, it is, what did we say? Life imitates art imitates life.
And I think of Abed from Community.
Yeah.
I used to tell people all the time in high school, like, that's how I relate to people is through watching films and TV. I watch a lot of TV as well. So.
Because you expect them to act like these archetypes.
And the archetypes sometimes got a little nuanced, so I could learn a little bit more about different people. And
yeah.
Sometimes... If the art is postmodern, I can see like, okay, there's really just no construct for personality. But in real life, there is. So there are personalities out there that are archetypes. So.
No, because I see that all the time because you start to see more than one with the same archetype.
Yes.
And you realize.
What would you group me in? I'm an INFJ.
INFJ?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was trying to think of whether there's an actual person that I'm like.
Mine is Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela.
Well, I've not met these people. I'm thinking like
John Snow.
I'll meet somebody and then I'll
Mother Teresa. Meet
somebody else in a different group and they have similar mannerisms and they act similarly to that other person. It's like that archetype carries over. They have different backgrounds and nature, nurture things and stuff. But the way that they act physically, it's like there's only so much variation we can have.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, with that, I think that you're like no other. I can't think of other people that are similar to you, Ben.
That's
not really
scary.
Sure.
There's got to be somebody else who's like
I think there are certain, like, very small pieces, but mostly you're an original concept. So
I'd say the same about you, Zach.
Yeah. I'd say I'm an original concept as well.
We're the two original concepts. That's why we have this podcast.
Yep. Yeah. I did look up a ton of reviews for Inland Empire, and I probably saw almost all of them. So hopefully we'll get our names out there with this. So anyway, I mean, this is going to be our least listened to.
Yeah, nobody. We are not going with our fan base right now. So yeah. we're
really lynching it up right now.
We're really trying to pull our fan base along with us rather than cater to them. Fan base out there listening.
Oh, for sure.
I'm not even referring to you as. I'm referring to you as our fan base in the third person. Not like those of you listening, you know, that's kind of how I think elevated art critics.
We don't want to get too close to them. Yeah. They're kind of gross to us.
Yeah.
We don't like them. In fact, we'd rather you not listen.
Yeah. That'll make us more niche and interesting if people don't listen to us.
That's true.
So
there are pros and cons, and we'll only display the pros on either side.
Yeah.
So if we get big, we're really good. If we are small, it's because people don't appreciate real art.
Right.
So
exactly.
With that, how do we even close this thing?
In heaven, everything is fine.
It's so funny because nobody's going to understand that reference. That's between you and I.
Everything is mine.